From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. In the Gulf War, American military women played a bigger role than ever before. On this edition of Fresh Air, we look at the changing role of women in the armed forces with an expert on the subject, Carolyn Beecraft. Also today, Philadelphia Inquirer columnist Steve Lopez discusses what he wrote about the war and what his readers wrote back. And we talk with award-winning playwright Tom Stoppard. He's just made his directorial debut, making the film version of his play, Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Colin Powell, said today that the Gulf War won't be considered over until there's a full accounting of all prisoners and those listed as missing in action. Powell spoke to the veterans of foreign wars as the group met in Washington. NPR's David Malpas has this report.
It's great to have a clean win, isn't it?
That's the way General Powell began his speech, which lavished praise on America's leaders, from the commander-in-chief down to the privates in the field, for achieving what he called a great victory against tyranny.
Ultimately, success in war belongs to those on the line who, in a cockpit or a tank or a foxhole, put their lives on the line to win. To each and every one of those brave young Desert Storm troopers goes our heartfelt thanks. An undying gratitude.
General Powell said the military services put aside traditional rivalries and demonstrated great teamwork. He called the war a textbook case of joint operations. I'm David Malpas in Washington.
Refugees from southern Iraq say there's been more violence in Basra, the country's second largest city. Iran's official news agency said that anti-government demonstrators had killed the provincial governor, the mayor of Basra, and the eldest son of Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein. Witnesses from Basra said the demonstrators carried portraits of a Shiite Muslim leader, Mohammed Bakr al-Hakim. Hakim leads a fundamentalist exile group that wants to establish an Iranian-style Islamic Republic in Iraq. Shiite Muslims are the majority in Iraq, which is largely governed by members of the rival Sunni Muslim sect. There's been no official response from the Soviet government to yesterday's overwhelming vote in favor of independence from Moscow in the Baltic republics of Latvia and Estonia. More than 70% of the voters in the republics voted to leave the Soviet Union. From Moscow, the BBC's Bridget Kendall has more.
In both Latvia and Estonia, local Baltic politicians have all along insisted their referendums were aimed at Moscow and the outside world. But even so, there was surprise and delight at the high turnout and at the signs a growing number of local Russians are now opposing the Moscow line. Over half the voters in one mainly Russian town in Latvia supported independence. The Latvian leader, Anatolis Gorbunovs, told a news conference this should influence Moscow to correct its Baltic approach. He said he hoped President Gorbachev would come up with new ideas before the end of the month. In Estonia, Republican leader Arnold Rutels was also hopeful. He called it a historic day for the Republic, and another senior politician said the clear yes vote should strengthen Estonia's talks with Moscow.
The BBC's Bridget Kendall. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 4 points today to close at 2,914. Advances led declines by a margin of 5-3 in heavy trading. This is NPR. Police in South Africa said that at least 24 people were killed and 15 wounded in tribal fighting in the black township of Soweto. The fighting reportedly broke out between members of the Zulu and Xhosa tribes. News reports said an argument broke out in a workers' hostel after Zulus demanded that Xhosa stop wearing T-shirts supporting the African National Congress. Chilean President Patricio Aylwin today revealed the findings of an official investigation into human rights abuses committed by the previous government. Aylwin accused the military regime, which stepped down a year ago, of having systematically murdered political opponents. He also called for a court investigation of the atrocities. NPR's David Wellner reports from Santiago.
In a strongly worded address to the nation, President Aylwin apologized on behalf of the Chilean state for the brutality of the armed forces and the negligence of the judiciary during the 16-year rule of former dictator General Augusto Pinochet. Aylwin said a presidential blue ribbon commission determined beyond doubt that at least 2,000 Chileans were murdered by the military. He called on the judiciary to investigate the whereabouts of secretly executed Chileans, as well as the identities of their killers. Elwin said such investigations don't conflict with an amnesty declared by the armed forces that exempts military personnel from prosecution for many of those crimes. I'm David Walna in Santiago.
A congressional analysis released today says that although the U.S. military has a disproportionate percentage of black members, its social and economic makeup is otherwise pretty typical. The Congressional Budget Office said that black people accounted for 22% of active duty armed services recruits, while comprising about 14% of enlistment age youth. The report said that, economically speaking, the all-volunteer army is not the army of the poor, as some critics have charged. The CBO found that about 45% of enlisted personnel came from areas with above-average family incomes. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In the Gulf War, American military women were deployed in larger numbers, in more types of jobs, and in positions closer to combat than ever before. They were the first servicewomen to fly helicopters on an air assault into enemy territory. They led chemical decontamination squads, serving alongside combat soldiers at the front lines. They flew refueling missions and worked as maintenance specialists. And they worked in Patriot missile battalions in both Israel and Saudi Arabia. We invited Carolyn Beecraft to talk with us about the new role of women in the American military. She's an expert on women's and family issues in the military. She established the Women in the Military Project for the Women's Research and Education Institute in Washington, D.C. She was an officer in the Army from 1966 to 1971. American casualties were remarkably light during the war, but early on in the war there was much speculation about what the American reaction would be when we saw women return in body bags. I asked Beecraft if she thinks Americans reacted differently to women dying than to men.
No. I think that the reaction to the body bags was always one of the things that those particularly that opposed increasing opportunities for women, that was one of their arguments. But we really haven't seen that over the last 20 years. Women have died in the military. Women have died in police forces, fire forces, and so forth. I think the American public understands that women that perform in these roles are doing dangerous jobs. They're there because they choose to be, and I think they respect that.
What were some of the logistical things that the military had to deal with that they've never had to deal with before because of the number of women?
I don't know that they really made any accommodations for the women particularly. The women deployed with their units. They didn't build separate dorms for them. They lived right along with the men. They ate along with the men. There was, I think, very little that was different for the military. I think the military women, though, were more kept to the bases than the men were because of the differences in Saudi culture. And I think maybe that was one of the, probably the biggest culture shock for the women over there was operating in a Muslim culture.
What were some of the reservations that you think the military had before the Gulf about a battle situation in which men and women were together?
Well, I think this is an important historical time because it certainly has to puncture the myths. There were certain myths that if women were involved in military units that it would destroy the cohesion of the units, that men wouldn't fight if women were around. And another myth was that women wouldn't deploy because of children and so forth. Well, none of those myths proved to be true at all. The women did deploy. The cohesion appears to be as high as it ever has, and then men didn't act funny because women were around. And then you get into the point where you have different services that behave differently. For instance, the Army is used to deploying women, and so is the Air Force, because they have done it in Grenada and in Panama and in countless other operations in the 80s. The Marine Corps was the most reluctant, and in the beginning was not going to send any women. They did, in the end, send a few women. I'm not quite sure how many. The Navy had women in ships in the Gulf, and it was a first for them. The Navy women were actually furthest from the battle scene, but they had many women that were serving on different kinds of ships. It was a first for them. So for all of the services, there were strides made.
Now, there are regulations in the services that keep women out of direct combat, yes?
There are two laws. There is no law that says that women cannot be in combat. This is kind of a common misconception, but there's no such law. There is a law that says that women cannot fly fighter aircraft engaged in combat missions, and then they cannot serve on ships designated as combat ships while they're engaged in a combat mission. That means that the women can't serve on aircraft carriers, destroyers, and frigates, although they did serve on supply ships and hospital ships. The Army has policies that says that women cannot be involved in what they call direct combat, and they define that as closing with and destroying the enemy. So that essentially means women are not in the infantry, they're not in the armor, but they are in the units that supply support to the infantry and to the armor.
Would you like to see those regulations changed, and would you like to see women allowed in combat positions or at least closer to combat?
I think that the laws in the Air Force and the Army, the Air Force and the Navy should be repealed. I think they've outlived their usefulness. They have their roots in World War II when you had a different kind of battlefield. Getting rid of these laws would not necessarily open up the infantry. That's a common misconception and misperception, and that's not true.
So you'd still like to see women kept out of hand-to-hand combat?
I think that physical strength is a legitimate criteria for closing, just as mental ability and physical ability are legitimate criteria for specialties, and the infantry and the armor require a high degree of physical strength, particularly upper body strength. There are some women that would meet that criteria, but most women would not.
But as far as flying a bombing mission, you think a woman could do that as well as a man? It's not about physical strength to fly a plane and release bombs accurately.
Exactly. Well, women are fighter pilots in Canada and in Denmark, and there'll be other nations. And even our U.S. women, some of them in the Navy, do fly those fighter aircraft because they train men in them. But they can't fly them in combat missions. They would like to, too, by the way.
Do you think that women's performance in the Gulf War will move women a step closer toward getting more equality in combat positions?
I think that it will. I think because when you talk about the discussion, you can't talk about the theory, the what-ifs. They have solid experience that demonstrates the capabilities of the women and their ability to work well with the units. So we move beyond the what-if to the, well, this is the way it was, this is the way it is. And that's a very important psychological jump.
I think one of the things that set the Gulf War apart from other wars on the home front was that we watched women leaving their young children behind as they shipped off to the Gulf. And in many instances, we watched mothers and fathers, you know, within the same family, having to leave their children in somebody else's custody so that they could go off and fight. Could you explain what the military policy is for parents?
Sure, I'd be glad to. Now, first of all, let's back up a little bit and say that the military of today is far different from the military of Vietnam. The military of Vietnam had a small core active duty component and then a large number of single male draftees. The military of today is primarily married. 90% of the career force in the military is married. So basically they're all parents, with the exception of those that are very young. So that is a big difference. The military has a policy that, and it's really a condition of employment, for those who are single parents and those who are dual military couples. They have a child care plan that they have to have, designating custody of the individual of their child in the event of deployment. By and large, this policy worked very well, but there were some exceptions, particularly in the reserve component, but by and large, this policy worked very well. You may be interested to know that there are more male single parents in the military than there are female single parents. That's very different from the civilian sector.
So if you're married and your spouse is in the military too and you have children, or if you're a single parent, you're required to have a dependent care plan. You're required to have somebody who you could give your child required to have somebody who you could give custody of your child to if you're deployed.
That's correct.
So you think this is something that all military family people are told that they have to think about before?
Most definitely. The active component has been, all the active forces have had this policy in place for, I would say, at least 10 years. And they have been very firm about it. I think where the problem came was in the reserve component. First of all, the reserves never thought that they'd deploy. So even if it was a requirement for them, it didn't have the urgency. It was sort of, yeah, well, what are the odds I'm going to go? The odds are probably nil that I'm going to go. Well, all of a sudden, they mobilized many, many reserves who didn't ever think that they'd be mobilized.
You know, still, as a civilian, it's mm-hmm. easy to think, well, the military hasn't really quite thought through a family policy for the new volunteer army in which there are so many parents who are involved. I mean, I think it broke the hearts of so many people in the country to see mothers and fathers having to leave their children
right.
behind. And everybody was thinking about how many children could have been orphaned had the war turned out very differently than it did.
Sure. Well, you know, and this goes back to the fact that we as a nation don't have a family policy. The military actually has a better family policy than most. Military women have a 6 weeks maternity leave with full pay and a guarantee of their job back. That's all military women, enlisted and officers. And they have child care centers at local bases, so the military has attempted to deal with the child care issue. So they, in many ways, they're ahead of the scale on a lot of these issues that have to do with family policy.
Well, now that the war is over and we've seen the way the family policy has worked, do you think that it's time to think about reform, or do you think that the war proved that the family policy works well?
I think the war proved that the family policy, by and large, worked well. I think that there will be modifications in their policy, and DOD has the power to do this. One of the things that they will do is that they will extend the period of time that a new mother has before she deploys. Right now, the Navy women had up to 4 months. Newborn mothers had up to 4 months before they deployed, but the Air Force and the Army women were to deploy after 6 weeks. I think what will happen is that they will extend that period to 6 months for all women in all services and standardize that. So, I think that that's very appropriate.
Carolyn Beecraft is my guest, and she established the Women in the Military Project for the Women's Research and Education Institute. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Carolyn Beecraft. Now, you were an officer in the Army from 1966 to 1971.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
That was during the war in Vietnam.
Right.
The military was very different, and the war was a very different war than the one America just fought.
Yes.
What were some of your problems as an officer then? Some of the things you felt that you were up against as a woman?
Oh, it's really very interesting. First of all, there was, by law, a cap on the percentage of women that could be in the forces at 2%. So there were very few women that were in the military at that time. Mostly we were in the medical or administrative fields. I was in the medical field. For instance, I got pregnant. I married and I lost my entitlements, and I got pregnant and I lost my job. Those were all policies that the military had. You couldn't be married. A woman could not be married to another military member and still get her housing allowance, for instance. And a woman could not be married. She could be married later on, but she couldn't have a child. She would be discharged. That was totally different. The opportunities that the women have today, they can go into almost any field with certain exceptions. And all of those fields were not open in my day. You couldn't be a pilot. You couldn't be in logistics. You couldn't be in intelligence, communication, military police, any of those fields that are open to the women today. They were all closed to me.
Maybe you can explain for us a little bit more about what your role as an officer was in the medical part of the military.
Sure. I was a dietitian, and in my last two positions, I was chief of the food service division at two separate hospitals. That meant I had overall responsibility for all of the feeding of hospital patients and the dietary therapy. And in those days, that included those men who were wounded in the Vietnam War and came back to the various hospitals to recuperate.
So you were stationed in Vietnam?
No, I was stationed here in the United States in a number of different hospitals.
So when did you get back into the military, and were you ever able to get your position back?
No, I was never able to get it back. In fact, I didn't even have the opportunity to go in the reserves because you couldn't go into the reserves either. I left in 1971.
Now, is what you were up against what drove you to start studying women's rights in the military?
Actually, it was. I did. I was getting my master's degree, and I had two choices of topics. One had to do with a nutrition topic, and the other was to measure the effects of the women's movement on wives of military officers, and I chose to do that one. And really, that began my work in the late 70s.
So what do you think the social factors have been and economic factors that have really been responsible for the changes of women's roles in the military in the past few years?
Well, you know, you have to go back. The most important change was the end of the draft and the beginning of the all-volunteer force, because then the military had to start actively recruiting women, and they had to start opening up jobs for them in order to maintain the numbers that they needed. That corresponded, as I said before, with the changes that occurred in the civilian world, where all opportunities opened for civilian women also. So I think that is a major change. The changes in the 70s also had to deal with the entitlements and pregnancy, so it allowed women to remain in the service, to marry, to have a family, and still maintain their service career. You've had a number of firsts. You've got women that are doing absolutely incredible non-traditional things. And I think that the military always has legitimized the status of groups that do not have power. And I think that the women's performance in this war has legitimized their status, not only in the military, but as citizens in this country.
Now, I want to go back to when you were in the military.
Sure.
And you were up against all these things. Did you think it was unfair when you married and you lost your entitlements?
Oh, absolutely. I fought that.
How did you fight it? What kind of recourse did you have?
Oh, I had very little recourse, but I went up through the chain of command, and I went to the inspector general, and I wrote to Washington, and I was just outraged that could happen to me. But I did not file a suit. But the internal army processes did not support me.
Well, what was expected of the so-called military wife then?
Oh, I've been one of those too. The army had a saying that if the army wanted you to have a wife, they would have issued you one. And culturally, that still underlies a lot of their assumptions today. The role of the army spouse or the army wife was to provide social support to the wives of the men in her husband's unit. So she was basically supposed to provide social support, have teas and coffees, and keep them busy.
Boy, you must have really resented that after being an officer yourself to
I never
be expected
did well.
To do this.
I really, the going from an active duty officer to a military spouse was and continues to be the most difficult transition I've ever made in my life.
Continues to be? Are you still expected to provide that kind of function?
Oh, it's still there. It's still there. I've gotten over it now. I deal with the system on the terms that are comfortable for me, and I have the support of my husband to do that. But it's been a long, hard struggle.
I guess I'm a little surprised because since there's so many dual military families now, where the husband and wife are both in the military, I would have thought that would have changed considerably for military wives.
But the military is a different kind of culture in that everybody that comes in at a certain time progresses at the same level in the same amount of time. So those in the senior leadership came in the 50s, and they are still acculturated that way. So there's a quite a generational difference present in the military, and there is in the military today. Young women do not feel the pressures that women my age felt, or women my age still feel. They don't feel the pressures. They have a different value system, and the system expects different things of them. And I think that's partly because there are so many more military women now.
What are the issues you see yourself as lobbying around now? What do you think are the priorities, the next steps for women in the military?
Well, I think the most important next step, well, there are a couple of them. First of all, it needs to be documented exactly what the women did over in every service over there. Because that's important. Always before in wars, when women came home and were discharged, their participation was not written into the history. So it's very important that that occur. I also think for military women themselves that they have finally proven themselves to their system in the way that is meaningful to that system. That is, they went to war, they won a war, and their participation was as valid as their male counterpart. So they should get a certain self-confidence about that. I certainly hope that they have, because they certainly deserve that self-confidence to deal with their system and address their issues directly with the system. And I think that that will happen.
A lot of people in the American public were really focusing on this issue of seeing women separated from their children as the women went off to the war. I was wondering if you have a sense of how the women in the military were reacting to that on the whole. Are they afraid of any regulations that would make it more difficult for them to fight because it would be more difficult for them to achieve equal status?
Yeah, yes, they are. First of all, most of the military women I know, and I think that most of the women in the Persian Gulf would be quite appalled at the way the discussions have taken place over here, because basically you're questioning their responsibility as parents. I mean, that's how they see it. Military women do not want any kind of legislation, because the legislation proposed would affect men also, it would disproportionately, percentage-wise, affect them. And they don't want that at all. They feel that they have made their choice, they understand the condition of employment, and that they have made their arrangements for their children, and that they've taken care of the best interests of their children within the terms of their profession. And they really are not real happy with all of this discussion.
Well, Carolyn Beecraft, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
Carolyn Beecraft is a military policy consultant in Washington, D.C. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio. From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air.
In Shakespeare's Hamlet, the characters of Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are bit players, but they're the leads in Tom Stoppard's play, Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead. Coming up, we talk with Stoppard about his new movie adaptation of his play. Also, we talk with Steve Lopez, a columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer, who says he's not sharing in the end-of-the-war euphoria. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Six former American prisoners of war arrived in Jordan today on their way to a hospital ship off of Bahrain. The six were released under ceasefire arrangements agreed to at a weekend meeting between Iraq and U.S. military officials. NPR's Jackie Lydon reports from Amman.
The six prisoners included 20-year-old Melissa Rathbone Neely of Grand Rapids, Michigan, the only female prisoner reported captured by the Iraqis at the Battle of Khafji in Saudi Arabia about a month ago. The six were released in Baghdad this morning and then driven to the Rawashed border, where they were flown by helicopter to a waiting U.S. medical ship near Bahrain. They appeared to be in good health and were given cheeseburgers and Swiss chocolates by the International Red Cross. They arrived in Jordan about 9 p.m. local time, but weren't allowed to talk to any reporters. The six include Navy Bombardier Jeffrey Zaun, Army Specialist David Lockett, Navy Lieutenant Robert Wetzel, and Air Force Major Thomas Griffiths. I'm Jackie Lydon in Amman.
The Iraqi media has indicated for the first time that there's unrest in parts of the country, with citizens protesting Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein's rule. Baghdad Radio quoted the deputy chairman of the ruling Revolutionary Command Council as calling on officials in some eastern provinces to pledge their loyalty to Saddam. Mike Theodula reports from Nicosia.
Izzat Ibrahim, one of Saddam's right-hand men, called on the governors of two eastern provinces to remain loyal to the president. He said major challenges were facing the Iraqi regime, but he didn't elaborate. The two provinces are among several in eastern Iraq where there are reports of widespread disaffection against Saddam's rule. Ibrahim's appeal was the closest Baghdad's come to acknowledging that Saddam's authority faces an unprecedented challenge. In Syria and Iran, Iraqi Shia Muslim groups claim that members of Saddam's Ba'ath Party and policemen have surrendered to or joined armed rebels in Basra, who they say now control the southern city. But eyewitnesses say heavy fighting is continuing, with Saddam's loyal Republican Guards turning their remaining tanks on protesters. The Iranian news agency quotes a refugee from Basra saying that Saddam's son, Uday, died in the clashes there. For National Public Radio, I'm Mike Theodulu in Nicosia.
British Prime Minister John Major is in Moscow for his first meeting with Soviet leader Gorbachev. Major is only spending 24 hours in the Soviet Union, where he is expected to talk about the situation in the Baltic states and post-war events in the Persian Gulf. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up over 4 points to close at 2,914.11 on volume of 200 million shares. Advancing issues led declines by a margin of 5-3. This is NPR News. In Washington, officials at the State Department are advising Americans not to ease their concerns about terrorism because the Persian Gulf War has ended. U.S. officials said today that during the war, there were some 160 incidents of terrorism around the world, about half of which were aimed at U.S. targets. According to a State Department study, few of these incidents could be linked directly to Iraq, and terrorism continues to be a serious concern. While there is at present no specific information concerning a terrorist threat to the American public, a State Department spokeswoman says officials are saying to be cautious. Rescue workers say that 3 people were killed and a dozen others were injured in an explosion at a Citgo facility in Lake Charles, Louisiana. NPR's John Burnett reports.
Citgo crews found the bodies Monday morning while searching through the rubble of a cracking unit that blew up at 11 p.m. Sunday. Officials from Citgo, which is owned by Petróleos de Venezuela, are continuing to look for more bodies, and they've opened an investigation into the cause of the accident. A company spokesman said 2 other catalytic cracking units were not damaged in the explosion. They're now in the process of being restarted. catalytic cracking units use great heat and pressure to refine crude oil into gasoline. The spokesman said that both units were shut down for safety reasons at the time the third unit blew up. He did not elaborate. The fire, which broke out Sunday night, burned itself out Monday. The refinery is located 5 miles from Lake Charles. This is John Burnett reporting.
In New York City, officials of the Daily News say the newspaper will cease publication the 15th of this month unless a binding agreement to sell the paper is reached by that date. Publisher James Hoag said in mid-January that the News would be sold or closed if agreements could not be reached with its 9 striking unions. In trading today in Europe, the dollar closed mixed against other major foreign currencies. Gold prices were also mixed. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Franco Zeffirelli has given us a new movie version of Hamlet with Mel Gibson as the troubled prince. Tom Stoppard has just given us a new movie adaptation of his play Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead. Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are minor characters in Shakespeare's Hamlet. They're Hamlet's old friends, summoned by the king and queen to find out what's been troubling the prince. They unknowingly become part of a plot to have Hamlet killed, but Hamlet has them executed instead. Rosencrantz and Guildenstern never understand the larger story they are part of. This predicament, so typical of minor characters, is the subject of Stoppard's absurdist comedy. The play first opened at London's National Theatre in 1967, and soon after had success on Broadway. Stoppard's other plays include Travesties, Night and Day, and The Real Thing. He also wrote the screen adaptations of Empire of the Sun and The Russia House. He wrote and directed the new adaptation of his play. I asked Stoppard why he wrote a story about minor characters in Hamlet.
The first thing I liked about them is that there were two of them, and the double act, you know, has a long and honorable comic tradition, and I can see why, because they're fun to write. And these two people, not Shakespeare's version of them, but mine, I turned them into the kind of double act which everybody is familiar with. There's usually one who's a little brighter and quite often angry with the other one who's a bit dim but sweet and so on.
Laurel and Hardy, Abbott and Costello.
A little like that, yes. And the other thing about them was that in the story which they've been dropped into, they have this sort of very strange predicament. When you look at Shakespeare's text, they're not really told what's happening in that play. And furthermore, when they end up dead, they don't know why. They don't know what they've done. In fact, they haven't done anything. So they're well-meaning, and they're often presented as villains, spies, on the side of the bad King Claudius. But in point of fact, there's no reason to look at them like that. Now, I found them rather endearing.
Well, you use a lot of wordplay in your work. And as a matter of fact, let me play a clip here of a scene in which Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are playing like word game tennis.
Yes.
You want to explain the way the game works?
The idea is that it's two people who have to avoid answering questions. They have to answer a question with a question, and the first time somebody forgets or breaks one of the rules, then he loses a point.
What's the matter with you today?
When?
What?
Are you deaf?
Am I dead?
Yes or no?
Is there a choice?
Is there a God?
Foul! No non sequiturs. 3-2-1, game all.
What's your name?
What's yours?
You first.
Statement. One love.
What's your name when you're at home?
What's yours?
When I'm at home?
Is it different at home?
What home?
Haven't you got one?
Why do you ask?
What are you driving at?
What's your name?
Repetition. 2 love. Match point.
Who do you think you are?
Rhetoric. Game and match.
Do you think of yourself as having played word games in Rosencrantz and Guildenstern as elaborate as the games Rosencrantz and Guildenstern play with each other?
What's happening is that there are these two people who are stuck there waiting for the next event to discuss and talk about. Between Shakespeare's scenes, they don't really have any purpose or role, and they pass the time in different ways. They discuss things, they speculate, and occasionally they get into some kind of game. Words is all they have available. They don't have TV or whatever. They're just there with themselves. So in some strange way, the predicament of the of the writer is the same as the predicament of the characters, because in writing the play, I was in exactly that situation, that they had a scene between scenes, and there was no plot that they were aware of, so they had to pass the time, and I had to invent ways to help them to pass the time. So we all three of us, Rosencrantz and Guildenstern and I, were in the same situation.
Now, one of the themes of your work is the difference between art and life, kind of comparing art and life. And both you and Shakespeare have used plays within plays. Do you think that's a good device for exploring the difference between art and life? Because, like, the framing play becomes reality, even though it's really theater, too.
Yes, it's something, I don't know why, but it's something about that which clearly appeals to me, because I've used it more than once, more than twice. There's something about writing about the relationship between one work of art inside or up against another known play by somebody else. There's something which makes sparks for me. And it got to a point a few years ago where I had to stop myself from doing another one of those. It was becoming a kind of mannerism. But anyway, in my case, I'm always writing about the ostensible subject matter, not the supposed subtext. And I'm constantly coming up against students, for example, who believe that I've written the play in a sort of attempt to disguise what I'm really writing about. And I know what they mean, because perhaps on some level you're doing that, but it's not, honestly, it's not really the way that writers think, I don't believe.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Tom Stoppard, and he just wrote and directed an adaptation of his play, Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead, so that is now a movie as well. And we'll talk some more after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air. Tom Stoppard is my guest, and he's adapted his play Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead into a movie, which he also directed. And by the way, you might be interested in knowing that he also wrote the screenplay for the recent movie The Russia House. Let's get into your background a little. You were born in Czechoslovakia, and your family fled because of the Nazis?
Yes, I mean, in a sort of general phrase, the gathering war, you know?
Is your family Jewish? Are you Jewish?
No, I think I had a Jewish grandparent, perhaps. No, there was just a sort of, I don't actually know, I was too young to have any opinion myself, but a lot of people left what looked as though it might turn into a theatre of war. And we went to Singapore, which was ironic because we got there in time for Pearl Harbor and the Japanese invasion. And we got, women and children went on boats. My mother tells me that our boat was supposed to go to Australia, but for some reason or other, while we were out at sea, it turned around and went to India, and that's how I ended up there.
So women and children were given the passage on the boats and the men stayed behind, so your father stayed behind?
That's right, and he died in Singapore. And after the war, when we were in India, my mother remarried an Englishman whose name I now have.
Stoppard.
Exactly.
Do you have a lot of memories of being frightened a lot when you were a child and your family was fleeing Czechoslovakia and then Singapore?
I think I remember being driven to the boat in Singapore, and I had a sense that there was some kind of air raid, and I certainly remember a Japanese Zero aeroplane with its nose in the ground, just sort of where it had crashed. I remember being in the air raid shelters. Everybody in my generation remembers the smell of sandbags. But in India, I'm afraid that, protected by the innocence of childhood, I never felt unhappy or worried or nervous. I mean, obviously I must have done sometimes, but in a general way, I look on India as being a lost domain of childhood happiness.
Have you been back there?
That's a very well-timed question. I never went back for 44 years until about a month ago. And I went back to where I used to be, and I went back to the school I was at and the houses we lived in. And it was in a certain way, it was an emotional experience, because these places had populated my dreams since I was 8. Though, in fact, having found these places again, of course, they lost some of their magic for me, because there they were. I mean, I went into this school where I used to be in this dormitory with lots of other little boys. I remembered it very well. And I went back, and it was still there. It was this room with beds in it, and that was it.
So you're not going to dream about it anymore, maybe, huh?
I think that may be so.
When you were writing the screen adaptation for Empire of the Sun, did you identify with the story at all, because you were in Singapore during wartime and you and your parents got away on the ship?
Yeah, when I was asked to write that screenplay, they didn't know that my own childhood wasn't that different from young Jim's. Was he called Jim? Yes. He was in Shanghai, but when I visited the location and saw the little boy's bedroom, it gave me a really spooky feeling, because the designers, who must have researched it very thoroughly, they gave him books and things stuck on the walls, which triggered off memories of my own. I mean, they were my books, and over his bed was a thing, a thing called Flags of All Nations, a sort of map, a chart of different flags. And I remembered suddenly having the same chart, Flags of All Nations, in my bedroom. So it was a real time trip. But as for writing the story, well, listen, I didn't get put in a prisoner of war camp, and I wasn't chased around by Japanese soldiers, no.
Do you ever think what it would have been like for you had you stayed in Czechoslovakia and ended up writing under, you know, a very repressive government?
Well, I may not have been a writer at all. Mm-hmm. I don't imagine. I can't. It's something which I've thought about once or twice, because I'm an acquaintance, perhaps a friend of the present president of Czechoslovakia, who's the playwright Havel, Václav Havel. And if I'd gone somewhere else other than England, perhaps I wouldn't have been a writer at all. If I had been a writer in Czechoslovakia, then I'm afraid I've simply no idea what I would have done, whether I would have, conformed or gone silent or been brave. I just don't know.
Have you seen the Zeffirelli Hamlet, the movie that just came out?
Yes, it's the first thing I wanted to do when I got to America. I saw it in New York. I really liked it.
It's, I guess, a kind of lucky break in a way, because people could see Hamlet and then see Rosencrantz and Guildenstern and put the whole picture together.
I think it's quite helpful.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Oh, I enjoyed it. Thank you very much.
Tom Stoppard wrote and directed the new film adaptation of his play Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert, what do you have from the Gulf?
Well, we try to piece together today what's going on in southern Iraq. Many reports of uprisings against the authorities in the south of the country, both by local Shiite Muslims who live in the south of Iraq, and also by troops who were streaming out of the war zone, heading through Basra and other cities. And we also begin today a series of interviews checking in with experts and journalists in various parts of the world that we haven't been covering very much for the past several months to sort of remind us of what's been going on there.
What stories are you checking in on?
Well, we'll start off with what's been happening in Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union and Germany today.
Well, thanks, Robert. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Steve Lopez is a Metro columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer, but like most people, he has strong opinions about the war, and he's written about them. Lopez questioned whether this war needed to be fought, and now he isn't sharing in the euphoria over our swift military victory. Yesterday, his first post-war column on the Gulf started like this.
All right, all right, all right. Some of you, pumped by the war and perhaps feeling a psychological need to keep up the pounding, have called or written to remind me I was against this thing from the beginning, as if I didn't know. It was nice of you to take the time, though I'm still waiting to hear from the guy who wrote during the war to say Saddam Hussein is a decent guy compared to me, or from the guy who thought I should be strapped to a missile. It might have been the same person, actually. I lost track. But only one person told me to go back to Puerto Rico this time. The more temperate critics, it seems, just want to know what I have to say for myself now that Saddam Hussein has been crushed like a cockroach, President Bush is a hero, and America is invincible.
Well, now that the war is over, you say you're not sharing in the euphoria. Why not?
Well, I happen to think, personally, and I'm no expert on the Middle East, but I think that it's too soon to know what we gained or what we lost. And I think that it's going to take months, if not years, for all of this to settle out, and we know if we really brought any more stability to that region. And what really bothers me is that in the middle of all of this euphoria, we're getting more and more news about tens of thousands of Iraqi bodies, mounds of corpses. And for me, one human life is not worth more than another. It worked. There's no question about that. It really did work. But I wonder if, because something works, that makes it morally right. And I think there are too many people quick to jump to the conclusion that it was all wonderful.
You know, in a lot of ways, you're in the position that a lot of Americans were in during the war, which is trying to make sense out of a situation in a very complicated part of the world, a part of the world in which you are not an expert. I mean, you're not a Middle East scholar. You don't usually write about the Middle East. You're more likely to write about sanitation problems in the city of Philadelphia than to write about the Middle East. But this was the kind of issue that you had to take a stand on, you had to have an opinion on. So I guess I'm kind of curious what it was like for you, figuring that you really had to take a stand, but it wasn't something that you felt like you really were an expert on.
Well, I think there's something of an imperative as a columnist, and I'm a Metro columnist, to write about what's on people's minds sometimes. And this is a thing which is on everybody's mind. For weeks and for months, everybody has talked about this. And no, I'm not an expert, but I do write frequently about responsibility in government, about honesty from our politicians. And I felt that we were moving too quickly and that we weren't, as an electorate, asking the right questions and challenging President Bush and Congress on this thing. And I just saw even locally that so many people were sort of jumping on the wagon. Early on, there were so many of these kill Saddam, stomp the Iraqis, just that kind of very shallow, simplistic, jingoistic response to something. And that offended me early on, and it made me wonder what kind of prejudices we might be stirring up. And I guess at that point, I thought that I should write about it. I'm a Metro columnist, but I had some real concerns about the potential for the loss of life. And I sort of felt that we were in a car headed down a hill without any brakes. That is how it seemed to be managed to me by the president. And I just wanted to be there to try to say, look, folks, let's put on the brakes, at least every couple of blocks and ask a few questions. And I saw that as my role. And no, I'm not an expert, but I just wanted to, from the beginning, say, wait a minute, let's think about this.
What's your next column going to be about?
Well, this is interesting. My next column is about community legal services, which is the Legal Aid Society that was established to take care of people who can't afford attorneys. I've gone around Philadelphia visiting CLS offices, and because under the Reagan and Bush administrations, their budgets have been slashed, the Philadelphia office, for example, has gone from 98 attorneys to 58. And more and more and more people each year are coming into those offices in need of help because there basically is no domestic program in the United States, or not much of one anyway. So they're turning away people from these offices who have legitimate problems, like they're being thrown out of a house. There's been some consumer ripoff. And their last resort is community legal services. And because of the cuts and because there just doesn't seem to be that much of an interest in taking care of some of the needs of the United States, these offices are really, really hurting. And I think it's important to do this column right now. One of the attorneys that I interviewed said, "I guess this is part of the New World Order," when I asked how he could explain this lack of support for people in need in this country at a time when we're spending, how much was it? I don't know, $70 billion on this war. It's entirely possible that we are now going to be spending more in federal aid on Kuwait City than we spend on Philadelphia. And I suggested in one of the columns that to the poor of Philadelphia and other cities, if you really want to go to a place where the federal government, the United States, is guaranteeing economic recovery and rebuilding, you might want to move to Kuwait or maybe even Iraq, where we've already suggested that we're going to have to start pouring millions, if not billions of dollars into their economy.
Well, Steve Lopez, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Steve Lopez is a Metro columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Thad Kirk, Dan Lachlan, Joyce Lieberman, and Audrey Voblaitis. Roberta Sherrock directed the show. Our theme music is composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by a grant from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we meet Anthony Hopkins. In the new movie, The Silence of the Lambs, he stars as a brilliant psychiatrist who is also a demented, cannibalistic killer. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.